I apologize. There's this change of title from the previously shown, and I also hesitated. We did recently some work on turbulence on hyperboloid, which is constant nervature, constant negative curvature surface. But eventually, I've decided to work to talk about this, which is just for a break with general pattern. It's mostly experimental work. There will be some new series yet unpublished, but it's like 5%, maybe 10%. 90% would be experiments, old and new. And I'll start from brief motivation, which probably is not needed here. So if you have hydrostatics, that what you discover that your density level must be the same as the level of your potential. And then for you do it for gravity, then you discover that any horizontal temperature gradient would immediately produce flow. There is no statics in which you have gradient along this. And then, of course, there is another way in which temperature gradient could produce flow if you have an unstable stratification and you can derive a criterion which makes the atmosphere stable, and it's basically 10 degrees per kilometer. And what really happens in the atmosphere, it has an average degree 6.5, which means that it's many cases thermally unstable, which anybody who flied, you know, a kite or a balloon or whatever knows very well. But we're interested mostly in the scales which are not the global scale, namely the difference between day and night. It's a global scale. That's definitely temperature difference between night and day part of the globe, and there is this big circulation created by this. And there is definitely the difference on the troposphere scale, which is 10 kilometers. So there is no doubt that sun, which is the source of any motion, anything that moves on this planet moves because of sun, right, of sun energy. So the interest is in the details, how actually sun makes it moving. And my question would be, there would be some works, which is a very simple laboratory experiment, but it's motivated. What drives these vortices? This is west coast, right? And which means scales like hundreds of kilometers. So if I see a big vortex in the atmosphere with 300 kilometers size, where it gets its energy from? From the big temperature gradient on a 10,000 kilometer scale, or from a small temperature gradient on a 10 kilometer vertical scale, right? So there's two, in a very oversimplified way, two scales in which sun puts energy into the atmosphere, and it's interesting how it can get into it. Here is this famous Nystrom gauge spectrum, and I am not going to discuss all the slopes, which is not that important. What is important that if this 10 kilometers and this is 10,000 kilometers, you see that this is basically very continuous spectrum. All the scales are excited, and it's not surprising. In a nonlinear system, if you excite one part of the spectrum, somehow nonlinear interaction is supposed to redistribute energy between different scales. The point is, if you look somewhere here, at this is 500 kilometers Ni, then you ask where it gets its energy, from here or from here, or maybe there is some kind of mixture of it. And I'm not going to answer this question, just a disclaimer. It's a very complicated system. I'll show you some simple laboratory experiments and some almost trivial theory which may be related to it. This is still work very much in progress. So let me reiterate what it is. So atmospheric flows are driven by the gradients. Those gradients are vertical, and those gradients are horizontal, but they're on a very different scales. And now, where these intermediate scales get energy from? And here is a puzzle, because we know that three-dimensional small-scale motion produce a direct cascade of energy. So if I put energy on a 10-kilometer scale in the convection, this energy is expected to be mostly dissipated at a millimeter scale. In turbulent atmosphere, the viscous scale is millimeter, fraction of millimeter. All the energy goes there into heat. That's what three-dimensional turbulence does. It has a direct cascade of energy from large scales to small scales. Now, if I have a large-scale motion, it's 10,000 kilometers, and the width is 10 kilometers, so it's practically very shallow, thin layer in which any big-scale motion cannot get energy, only vorticity towards small-scale motion. So what I have a source at small scales, which could only get energy down to even smaller scale. And I could source at large scales, which could get energy only to even larger scales. So how the hell energy in between gets its energy? The motion in between gets its energy. That's the problem in its most simple idiotic formulation, which surprisingly you never find in a textbook. I mean, people who work in the field, they know it, but it's somehow, you know, something that people talk behind closed door. Now, just a few details. This is, of course, if I would be interested in two dimensions, that would be earlier equation in 2D, and it has two integrals of motion, and the energy goes towards small k, and the vorticity goes towards large scale. And then again, this is a simple picture of inverse and direct cascade experimental picture, and both these cascades, inverse and direct, produce the same Kolmogorov scaling. Namely, if I'm interested in what is the scaling of delta V, it scales like R in the power of 1/3, and I'm not interested in anything about anomal scaling. The difference is that if I look at a third moment, then it has this relation for any d, but the sign is actually different because epsilon has different signs in 3 and in 2 dimensions. If it's a direct cascade, then I would take epsilon positive, and the third moment of velocity difference will be negative. I will return to this point. I want to really stress it. And if I have my inverse cascade, then I must take epsilon negative, and the third moment will be positive. And maybe the work of theoretician in this field is to hammer this message that don't look at spectra, which people do happily for last 50 years. Look at third moment. That's where physics is. That's what actually tells you what's going on. So we'll be talking about third moments and how to measure it and what they tell you, etc., a lot. So now, again, those spectra. And here are simple initial experiments. So let's start from thin, very thin layers and see what actually happens when we excite motions in this thin layer. This is all classical works by Zameria and then Patrick Tabeling. And what they actually show is that you excite, here you see you started from these small scales and you get this inverse cascade and grows, grows. And if you are happy and you have low enough friction, that you get a big coherent system size condensate. And condensate, of course, that's because we also want Nobel Prize, so we always call whatever coherent, we call it condensate, like this for the Einstein people. But the point is that this inverse cascade in a finite box would also produce some kind of a big coherent motion, okay? Which is, come to think about it, pretty non-intuitive. So turbulence produces coherence. That's the meaning of inverse cascade, if you wish. And I now want to talk a little bit about our own experiments and some details about this. So again, we're talking about thin layer. There is no internal three-dimensional motion so far. It's just laboratory experiments by the group of Michael Schatz in Canberra. And again, it's a Tabeling type. Namely, we have electrolyte, small magnets behind. We put currents through it. Lorentz force excite vortices. In the last modification, we have 900 vortices excited. So this is a picture which appears initially as you drive current, then you see this time development of the inverse cascade and then creation of this big vortex. Then you can study a lot of details. For example, you switch it off, you measure the decay with which energy decays, then you can compare it with the energy flux in a steady state before you switched off, which forces this vortex. And you can show that they are the same, namely that this is indeed inverse cascade, that this big vortex, when it's steady, gets on its all its energy by the inverse cascade that comes from small scales. This is really something which was measured. Then again, you can see how it develops. This is a box 15 centimeters. This is a box 23 centimeters. You see that the spectrum, this 5/3 spectrum, actually continues even further away. Then you look at the third moment, which again, it's an inverse cascade. Epsilon is negative, so you expect third moment to be positive. Then you find it negative, and which also people did in some atmospheric measurement. So you say, what the hell? We just saw there is no energy source except the small magnets. And then you realize that to study turbulence, you need to subtract mean flow. And then after subtraction mean flow, which is this, then you see that it is indeed a positive slope. And its slope indeed equal to this dissipation rate that we measured after we switch it off. We can measure the dissipation rate immediately. So important message here that when you have a system in which there is a mean flow and some kind of a random or high frequency flow, you don't do nonlinear moments before you subtract it. And we did subtraction by making 35 or 40 or up to 50 periods we did temporal average, and what we got was a mean flow, and then we subtracted it from every snapshot, and then we did spectra. This intermediate scale is basically already, it's a half box size. It's basically the size of the vortex, if you wish. This is one vortex configuration. It's not a dipole. It's just, actually, it's five vortex configuration. We have big vortex inside and four lubricating vortices in the corner. So this is twice the size of the small vortex. This whole configuration is non-trivial. Again, so you do this mean subtraction, you recover the positive flux, you recover the five-thirds spectrum, you can study flatness and all the other minor details. Now let's talk about the big vortex itself. It appears over and over, so it might be that its details are independent of the way that we excite. It's a big guy, and whatever our mechanism of excitation at small scale, it has a whole inverse cascade to get it. And of course, immediately we started to ask, this is the first measurement, and just because we were doing it after numerics done by Colm Kanaton and the work with Chertkov and Lebedev, and they also fitted it by 1.25. This is a you actually can fit it by many things, including the Knot power law. And so this is a numerical data by Colm. This is this work. And this is our experimental data. And we all were hypnotized by a completely Pythagorean idea that if you actually, like what we've seen in the previous talks, if you write this mean flow and linearize with respect to the mean flow and look for zero modes, which are steady modification of this flow, they have some scaling exponent, which depends on the scaling exponent of the mean flow. And then you do some kind of Pythagorean looking at it, and you discover that if so your scaling is 5 over 4, this equation has a simple solution, and it's a rational solution. And so they published paper about it, and some people here probably heard me talking about it some time ago. This theory is completely wrong. We just power counting is not a theory. To get a theory, you need to calculate moments. And in this theory, you can just calculate moments and show identically that at every order, a moment, flow of momentum, what you need? Vortex, you need a flow of momentum inside it. It's identically zero. Then we started to look more carefully. And this is now work which we finished. And this is mostly numerics done by Jason Lurier with Guido Buffetta, and the theory. You'll see in the next slide, a very simple theory is done by us, by Igor Kolokolov, Lebedev, and myself. So this is this. Now we're doing numerics. And so because in the periodic domain, and the total vorticity is zero, so what we have excited a dipole. This is a dipole which appears after inverse cascade. And then when we look at it, and it's now much, much better resolution, you see it's really, this is a mean vorticity. It's more like 1 over r than 1 over r in the power 5 over 4, which would correspond to a constant velocity, independent on the distance. And then, of course, you immediately say, okay, let's do very simple theory. Let's just take Navier-Stokes, actually earlier equation, with the forcing. With the forcing is a small scale. Just average it. So you get the u is a mean flow, and the everything small is a small flow. So here is your u. It's an azimuthal mean flow. Alpha is a linear friction coefficient over here. It's just bottom friction in the experiment. So this is the equation which tells you that the flux of momentum through the vortex compensated by linear friction. And this is the energy conservation. It epsilon is just F times V. It's how much energy you input per time. It's constant, which is independent on places. This is the linear friction dissipation of energy. This is the flux of energy due to mean flow. And what is neglected here is VU cubic terms. So you neglect fluctuations. And also here, you neglect quadratic terms. So it's an assumption. So let's make simple idiotic assumption that fluctuations are much smaller than the mean flow. It's like visible, right? And see what it gives. Now you take U capital from here, you substitute it here. It's a solution. And this is a solution. U is constant. And it gives you an amplitude, which is a square root of 3 energy flux divided by alpha. So that's, if you wish, prediction. Of course, you know the life. And of course, it was first obtained numerically, and then for this beautiful theoretical prediction is given. So here, this line is a theoretical prediction. This is a JSON data. So you see that indeed U capital is almost constant. Well, 1.5 decade, I would say. This is 1/10 of the box size, this. So it's still 1% of the area of the whole system, right? But it's kind of still, I mean, we have enough resolution to see it inside. This ratio of velocity, RMS fluctuating velocity divided by mean velocity, you see that everywhere inside this region, it's between 10 minus 1 and 10 minus 2. So in a sense, it substantiates this prediction. So I believe that we now understand the structure of the mean vortex, and the structure corresponds to U equal to constant. Unfortunately, no beautiful theory with zero modes. It's just simple, straightforward, pumping, flux, compensate each other, you get constant profile. Okay, now let's move on, and these are now try to move to the thick layers. What would actually happen? Yes?
Just ask for clarification. So U is the azimuthal velocity?
Yes.
But if it's constant, I mean, it has to become zero at the core, right? By continuity.
No, it's not. If you look into it, it's you have inside. Yeah, the question was that if U is a constant, it's supposed to be zero at the point R equal to zero, of course. But here you see it goes down. It's actually very viscous domain inside. Viscosity plays almost no role in the whole region. And in numerics, we use hyperviscosity. But inside, it goes to zero, which is not shown here because it's logarithmic scale. U is constant between the very thin core and about 1/10 of the box size.
1/10 of the box size is what in terms of? 1/10 of the box size, is it the vortex size?
It's a it's 1/2 of the distance between vertices, if you wish. Well, or 1/4. I mean, this tenth, for theoretician, it's a parameter of order unity. But you need to squeeze two vertices into some system. Between two vertices, you have actually a strip which is a vorticity free. You have positive vorticity here, negative vorticity here, we're on a torus, right? So you have a kind of a region where vorticity has a zero line. And everything is not azimuthally symmetric over there. So this 10% is basically the region where you're near vortex and you're still approximately axially symmetric. So you can describe it by axially symmetric profile. As you go away, it's already completely different symmetry. You distort it. Okay, now thick layer. And now you tried.
You're not out of it yet here. Wait a minute.
Okay, yeah.
Can you clarify the forcing in the experiment? Is it white noise in time? Is it rapidly decorrelating?
Forcing in the experiment or in the theory?
Both.
In the theory, it's just white noise. And in the numerics, it's practically white noise. In real experiments that we do, it's a permanent current and permanent magnets. But because of sweeping, it's actually short correlated in terms of this big time of vortex rotation. So on the scale of vortex rotation, it's a short correlated forcing correlative. Now Michael has different way of excitation, and it seems they all work practically the same. Namely, all this big picture doesn't depend much on the structural forcing at small scales. That's the statement.
Okay, we should discuss that later.
which means that, there are some subtleties with another way of forcing, which is parametric excitation, but I don't want to go into it now. Now, these are numerical data by Antonio Celani and Stefano Andario, and this is already a little bit more recent data. So what they did, they took a box now, thick, not thin, and they varied and made it wider and wider and wider. And what is here, this ratio is the depth of the box divided by the force scale. So this is practically thin layer, and this is already thick layer. This is 1/2. And so you see that energy grows, and growth of energy means inverse cascade, that as you energy is not dissipated by viscosity, it goes towards large scale. So you see that as you make your box thicker and thicker, this rate with which energy grows goes down. So this is practically zero growth rate. This is 1/2. And so what was concluded in this numerics, that you ask when you can treat system as two-dimensional and when you can treat system as three-dimensional if it's really some thick or thin layers. And the statement is, if the ratio of your force scale is twice the depth of your system, it's already three-dimensional. You would never get an inverse cascade. This was absolutely heroic. There was 2 months on a big supercomputer, because you need to, it's not like two-dimensional turbulence. It's real three-dimensional turbulence with a huge, I mean, big aspect ratio and with this ratio of forcing. Fortunately for experimentalists, and this is the scheme of our experiment, it's much, much cheaper to run long simulation because nature does it for you. And so we did it and let nature run its course. This is approximately time which corresponds to these 2 months on European supercomputer. And so you indeed see that you have a three-dimensional, this is again, ratio is two of the force scale to the depth. You see that practically three-dimensional turbulence, it's mostly small scale, there is no big vortex, no inverse cascade, nothing like this. Then we let our supercomputer to run just for 15 more seconds. And that's what we discover after 15 seconds. That's our work. And the most important person here, not Hua, who actually did most of the experiment, and not Michael, who built the lab, but this PhD student, David, who will later appear in this story in a very interesting part of it. So you see that if you wait long enough, then you recognize that even though what seemed to be no inverse cascade was a small leakage of energy towards larger scales. It built it. And when this big vortex started to appear, it completely changed the nature of the motion in this layer. So now when you look at it, you see that it's not two-dimensional. It's strongly dependent on vertical coordinate, but it's planar. So it's there practically no vertical velocity. And the mechanism is kind of more or less understood. This is not artist's sketch. This is experimental data. It's a beautiful system of visualization that we can really get a three-dimensional data. This is now that you can see. This was after 5 seconds. This was after 20 seconds data. So you see what actually happens. We have a big vortex appearing, which apparently is a result of inverse cascade. All the energy here is from small magnets at small scales, right? So we see that really, if you are interested in this scale, which is intermediate scale, and you ask me where it got its energy, immediately answer from small scales by inverse cascade. There is no input of energy at large scales. Okay? So again, it's a very simple system. It's a very simplified setting. But what is important, and which is kind of straightforward to learn from here, the system has a way to organize itself. When it has a large scale flow, it happened to influence strongly the small scale turbulence. And this small scale turbulence, instead of being totally three-dimensional and giving all the energy to dissipation, start to give away this energy to large scale. So this big guy actually provides its own energy supply by rearranging turbulence inside. The moment it appears, it doesn't want to die. It would keep turbulence feeding it just by suppressing the mechanism by which this vertical motion is suppressed. This is more or less shown here. Is just this vertical shear of this big vortex. It just stretches all the vortices and kills all the vertical component. So this basically is this simple.
What's the scale of the thickness of the light vortex? What
you this is a box scale. We have insertable boundaries, which means that we can insert boundaries on the scale of 20 centimeters, 50 centimeters, and we cannot make more. We tried, but it does not work. So in a sense, if, again, it very much depends on the bottom friction. And if bottom friction is small enough, we can have inverse cascade going towards larger and larger scales. You insert... This thickness is how much electrolyte we put there. Again, the role of theoretician here, you ask why I'm saying our experiments. Other people did it. My role was just saying for almost 2 years, just add more water. At some point, they heeded this cry for help, and they added 2 millimeters of water, and we started to observe all this stuff. It's not very easy to do experiments with thick layers. This is 5 millimeters. It's very thick. Okay. Now, of course, we can play with it. In particular, we can have this big vortex imposed by a big magnet, not produced by Inversky skate, and this would make it controllable. So we can actually see how this big vortex was. So this is a configuration in which initially we had turbulence, then we put a big vortex into it. Unfortunately, it completely blocks optical system, so we cannot measure. So then we take it away and start to measure. And we see that that's what immediately, this is 1 second after we removed big vortex. We see that this is practically planar motion, but of course some troubles start from the bottom. And then after 9 seconds, you see a return to three-dimensionalization. And this is a very big box in which by itself the vortex does not appear. The source of energy always is a small scale source. It's always here. So I have this turbulence, it works, and it's steady. Then I put my big vortex by magnet, then I removed my magnet. But current and small magnets works all the time, okay? So I just see, but because it's a very big box, there is no vortex appear by inverse cascade. I imposed vortex, and then it disappears after a while. Again, then you can see how, again, by subtracting vortex, you can, this is, you can see the third moment and a positive flux into it. And you can actually see that this is this data that without imposing the vortex, we've seen this spectrum, and there's practically not much energy at low k, no inverse cascade, nothing like this. Then we impose the vortex, and you see this appear, the whole spectrum, the total spectrum is blue. If you subtract the vortex, namely averaged over 30 periods, you see this 5/3 cascade which is inside it, which I'm still not sure that it's 5/3. Theoretically, sometimes, I mean, we have some theoretical scheme in which it must be k minus 1. And then again, you look at the third moment, there were practically no flux without vortex. Then you impose vortex, you see a strong positive third moment, which means negative flux, which means inverse cascade. So this more or less understood. And here is a simple moral, which one can get at this point, that the large-scale flow effectively suppresses fluctuation in the vertical velocity. And the resulting planar flow, even though it's not two-dimensional, but it has no mechanism of providing direct energy cascade. So the energy goes towards large scale. And that's basically the way how the big vortex supplies its own energy supply. And now the last part of the story, which is now directly related to the David, who finished his PhD and went to work in other place. And he analyzed data obtained by some incredibly brave people who flew in 2003 into hurricanes. They actually flew into two hurricanes. This, I guess, is Isabel date. Yeah, this Isabel, it's this date. This was a pretty big hurricane, and actually took part of North Carolina and kind of disappeared it into the ocean. It was a really big event. And the aircraft flew inside and then outside. Here is a track. And also on different heights. And measured the wind velocity inside. And then one, and this is a huge data, which, by the way, I invite other people also to use. It's a database which can be used. So David, with his co-author, analyzed this database. And again, I'm very proud that this message of theoretician is really absorbed by Michael's student, measure the third moment. So he measured the third moment. Again, subtracting the mean flow, everything doing correctly. And this is the third moment as a function of a height. So if you look here, this two corresponds to low height. This is 88 meters. It's pretty scary, by the way. Just think about it, to fly on this height inside a big hurricane, right? And you see the negative third moment, which means positive flux, which means direct cascade. Then as you go higher, it's a clearly, first of all, it's a decent scaling in some interval. So you see how direct cascade goes into inverse cascade at relative, at sufficiently high altitude. And the same, this is a Fabian. This is another, you know, it's now gender equality, so we have also male names for hurricanes. This is a Fabian, another big guy, and this is this data. Again, I don't have here heights, but basically the same low heights. It's still three-dimensional, and at some point you see that the third moment practically indistinguished from zero, and then you see that at higher moments you have a negative, which means that inverse energy cascade. Of course, it's not a global picture. It's a very, it's still a large-scale event, but it's at least it shows that in the atmosphere, it shows that there is 2D upscale energy flux. It's a very three-dimensional system, right? And it's a system which is many complicated things happened, and the sources of energy are, of course, there is internal sources of energy. But it shows that this large-scale parent vortex may gain energy directly from small scales, at least in these tropical cyclones. So I think that this whole idea that there are inverse cascades where you don't expect them to be, namely in the situation which definitely looks three-dimensional, but the point is that the moment that you have a big vortex inside, it somehow organizes the system in such a way as to supply its own energy source. And so let me get to the summary. I did not talk about invariance, so let's just skip this first line. But the point is that the inverse cascade produces this coherent mode, and this condensate, they interact non-trivially with fluctuation. In particular, we see how they suppress fluctuation inside, and that would actually determine the profile of these vortices. And they appear of universal form, and it seems that at least in this thin layer and in only purely two-dimensional turbulence, this is a very simple form. It's just u is a constant in some interval. And then as the last lesson is this is small-scale turbulence, a large-scale vortex can conspire to provide for an inverse energy cascade. And I'll finish here just with advertising for a book, as already customary here. Okay.
That's okay. It. Wait for the mic.
I can hear part from any point.
So, Grisha, you were using energy flux and cascade somewhat interchangeably in your discussion. I mean, have you, in the experiments, have you made measurements of things like bicoherence to investigate locality of energy transfer? The question is, I'm curious about what is the mechanism by which the large-scale vortex puts its footprint to extract the energy from the small scales? Is it conventional cascade idea, or is it more non-local transfer, which you could understand from more kind of like modulational picture?
Excellent question. First of all, in every non-uniform specialist system, we need to distinguish the flux in space of energy, let's say, and the flux in the spectral space. So first of all, if you are interested in the vortex, it's actually better to talk about the flux of momentum. But there is an energy flux related to it. Then the answer is this is a local in space flux of radial momentum going outside from turbulence. It would be very interesting to clear the physical picture. This is basically when you have positive and negative vortex inside, you see a very beautiful sorting, positive right, negative left, positive right. You actually can see it in the atmosphere when blocking appears, it also sorts synoptic perturbation in this way. So this is a special.
It sounds like modulation process, right?
In a sense, yes. But there is also, you produce a wrong sign vortices inside the, you know, there is a kingdom of positive vortex, but you produce negative vortices by forcing there. It just squeezes it and they disappear very fast. But negative reinforces the vortex. But this is a special picture. Now, if you're interested in a spectral picture, that what you do, you filter out your big vortices. You make sure that what you see is really almost specially uniform. And then you can study things like the third moment and Kolmogorov's four-fifths law and all this stuff on the remaining part. And then you can see what is really happens in the Fourier space. And that's what actually we did.
Okay, we have a question over here. Yeah, so Joe and Lindbergh measured third order structure functions from aircraft data a long time ago and came to the conclusion that epsilon was negative and there's a downscale energy transfer. So how does,
yeah, in particularly,
why is that different?
Our work was inspired by this, that we checked, first of all, in our experiments that if we directly measure the third moment, it would also be negative as if it is direct cascade. But when we subtracted mean value over many periods, we get it's positive. Of course, Eric cannot do it, I mean, subtract this average. So I don't know. And more or less, I don't even claim that this is directly related to the atmosphere. It's a much more complicated system. But my, you know, question to the data of Lindbergh is shows that they used non-average data. And in the non-average data, you can get different signs of flux.
Yes, I agree with Pat. One problem I have with your talk is you always speak about direct and inverse cascade and not non-local transfer of energy. So you can, that's the problem I have, because it's really, I start from one point, I go up or I go down, but you can have a large scale that could feed energy in a scale which is quite remote. Of course, you need to be clear with the, you know, triadic rules of how they interact, but there is not only direct and indirect cascade, there is also non-local transfer of energy. So did I understand your answer to Pat, where you say you don't get this non-local transfer of energy if you subtract the mean flow, is that what you are saying? That if you keep the mean flow, you could see this non-direct cascade or non-local transfer, but if you take it out, you don't see them? I'm a bit surprised about that, but
Let me reiterate again. And everything here was about non-local interaction. In a sense, this small-scale turbulence would produce direct cascade without very non-local interaction with a big vortex. But I don't have a theory of it, right? So I'm just have a theory of a simple mean flux of momentum of energy in space. That's the trivial part of it. Now, what I'm saying, when I subtract my mean flow, and when I look at the fluctuation, then this fluctuation among themselves, fluctuation of closed order, locally transfer energy, which goes in the negative direction, namely from small vortices to large vortices. But all this accompanied by a very non-local interaction with the mean flow. It would not happen if I would not have this big mean flow, right? So that's basically the picture.
Yeah.
You don't have a mic.
Yeah, mic. So back to your picture where you showed the satellite picture of vortices. So the large-scale dynamics in atmosphere and ocean is affected by the rotation. So how would you expect this is this change your results?
I don't have any results about tropical cycles. Make no mistakes about it. Nobody else has any decent theory, I mean, even approaching it. And it's a very complicated system. Apart from rotation, there is also a heat release inside. I mean, it's a very complicated system.
Yeah, I mean, you were saying, okay.
The point is, this is an empirical measure of what's going on locally. And when you locally ask what's going on and you subtract mean flow, then you have turbulent fluctuation. You check that they are relatively uniform and isotropic and calculate the third moment. The third moment tells you what locally happens with energy. It goes from small vortices to large or from large to small. Empirical observation in a tropical cyclone, you have a region where energy goes from small vortices to large. That's all. There's no theory here. Nobody knows what rotation plays a role. Rotation definitely wants to two-dimensionalize things too, right? So I don't know. It's just empirical observation.
I mean, you could include like bottom topography in your experiment, right? In the bottom slope in your experiment, that means like it is pretty cheap, and then it can change the results significantly.
It would take another 2 years, maybe three. It's a 4 millimeter size experiment in which we spent a huge effort on keeping it horizontal. Now you put topography on the bottom, and you open Pandora box of everything. Just, I mean, people in this room probably know much more than me about these things. But I mean, it's probably doable. So build an apparatus and do it.
Okay, I can't resist the comment though that you're offering us a theory of atmospheric motion that does not include potential energy at all. Am I correct?
Potential vorticity.
Potential energy.
Again. All the experiments that they took, they were definitely...
No, I'm talking about you're presenting weather maps of synoptic scale eddies, and you're implying that you're explaining them by a theory that does not contain potential energy.
I need to apologize. I repeat it several times.
Yeah.
I do not explain it.
Oh,
I'm not
I see.
Even sure that it's directly related.
Oh.
I show you simple system,
okay,
which has some properties which I am sure are present in the atmosphere as well. But in the atmosphere, there are many other things present.
I think I'm speaking on behalf of meteorologists in the audience who may have heard of a graduate student at UCLA named Jewel Charney. That's all. Okay, we have time for one more. I don't want to...
Actually, sorry for being boring, but I'm coming back to paths and Sasha's.
Where energy flows in K space or in R space?
No. Okay. Everybody so basically, just logically. Okay. So there's no local transfer, which is dominant, right? And then you say you eliminate it, and you get local transfer, which is has a different sign. I want to understand what's the significance of the local transfer, which is subdominant to the much stronger non-local one.
There are two different things. You have energy transported in space. There is more energy here than there is energy there, right? So there is a flux of energy in space. Just, you know, from this point of the box and this point to this point of the box. This is one part.
I'm talking about scale.
Now
scale.
You ask, okay, now I am in this part of the box. In this part of the box, I am asking where energy locally goes from small scales to large scale or from large scales to small scales.
But okay? Even locally.
These are two different
Grisha, places. Even locally in space, right, you can have spectral transfer just because there is shear there and strain, right?
I'm not saying where it came
so
from.
So if you eliminate shear and strain by eliminating large-scale structure,
of course,
you eliminate this part of transport.
Okay, I don't eliminate it. I have a vortex, and I have a profile of this vortex, and this profile of the vortex provides for the flux of energy inside of the vortex, right? I have this, actually shear is this U over R, and this is what something which provides this. Moreover, in the experiment, in the SICK experiment, it is this big vortex which actually produces flow, which is planar. Otherwise, there would be no inverse cascade, right? But again, is it just two different parts of the system? One is a flux in space, which is better to talk about momentum, by the way. It's simpler than energy. I have an angular momentum which supports this vortex. But everywhere inside this vortex, I have locally spectral transfer, which I can measure.
Okay, we have a choice, either lunch or more questions. Those who want lunch, it's that way.
I intentionally...
Thank you very much.